technology increasingly affecting every aspect of our lives, it's important to understand how it affects us psychologically. Welcome to the Psychology of Technology podcast, where we look at how humans and machines collide. So, welcome to the Psychology of Technology with myself, Kareem Tawansi, and the wonderful Brett Raven.
G'day.
G'day. Is that what you're going to go with? That's what a Canadian trying to sound like an Aussie sounds like. So, how's your week been, man?
Yeah, it's been pretty hectic, pretty productive, feeling pretty good.
Yeah. What are the top three highlights?
I had dinner with some friends last night down at the waterfront, which was beautiful, beautiful 23-degree warm evening. It was quite nice.
So in case we do get any, well, first of all, we've got to get our first listener. But in case we get any international listeners, we are based in Sydney, Australia, despite Brett's strange North American accent. And last night it was 26 degrees. It was the first week of spring. And there's a new development on the harbour called Barangaroo, nice Aboriginal word. And we were sitting in a lovely Vietnamese restaurant, the three of us just enjoying the beautiful weather and chatting about all of the important things in life. So I've been thinking about, well, obviously through COVID times, I've been thinking about what they call zombie businesses, businesses that survive and those that don't. And I think on the topic of zombie businesses, there are a lot of businesses that probably weren't zombie businesses before COVID but have become that way. The question is, what happens once we are in our post-COVID world, the new normal, as a lot of people refer to it? Which businesses will survive, which ones won't? And I've been thinking a lot about why a business exists and what makes a business exist in perpetuity. So some of the things that I've been thinking about have been what differentiates businesses within a particular market. So I'm going to start off by talking about the way I look at it. And obviously, Mr. Raven, you have your perspective, which sure. we will go through. So the way I look at it is that a business exists to provide a service or a good in any particular industry or vertical or horizontal. And it generally exists in perpetuity because there's something about it that is valuable. And that value aspect of it could be anything from a system, product, to even pricing. If you look at Bunnings, hardware chain, their whole thing is pricing. It's probably a variety of products plus pricing, if you think about it. They have everything, and it's usually the cheapest. So that's their value proposition, as they say. Obviously, I'm looking at it from a software perspective, and the way I look at it is that from a software perspective, there's various layers of software. Think of it as three layers. There's the systems of record, there is the industry-specific layer, and then there is what's unique about your business. So from an examples point of view, you could be using generic HR systems, you can be using generic accounting systems, and that's your systems of record, obviously tailored to your business to a certain extent. Then you might be using a product that is unique to your particular industry. But even at the industry level, I still think, what makes a business different? Otherwise, why do you go to one business in a particular market over another? And then you have that sort of pointy end, which is the bit that's unique. And my worldview is that's when you would be looking at a custom solution or a tailored solution. You and I had a chat about this during the week. I think you have a slightly different perspective, if I'm correct.
Yeah, I agree with you that we've got the base level, which is the system of record, and there are some generics in there, whether it's an ERP system, payroll, you know, that kind of technology. As we go up the chain further, one of the things I'd like to think about is systems of interaction. So you have a forward-looking application, it may be a website, an app, some sort of presence on a social channel, that kind of thing. And those are the areas at which you can still leverage out-of-the-box capability, but it needs to be configured in a way that makes sense for your business. So trying to leverage the things that are unique about your business and how they're presented to the real world. So I think that level of generic ubiquity of technology going further up the stack is getting better these days, depending on where you look in the market. There's still, as you know, so many options of choosing the kind of tool, the right tool for the right job. And there's lots of different ways of thinking about that now, whether you go for best of breed, you spot produce solutions across different aspects of your business. My previous job, I had that very scenario where we had 42 different applications that we would use in some capacity that would be either working with or monitoring or doing analytics off the back of systems interactions. The other approach would be to take more of a platform approach where you have a set of tools within an environment that you then leverage, which may not be best of breed necessarily, but they fit within the same ecosystem. So there's a lot less in terms of data silos, integration issues, multiple billing, multiple vendor management, and so on. So I think the systems of interactions place is coming through a bit of a consolidation phase at the moment, to be honest.
Okay, so on that, there's a couple of things that come to mind. So you're talking about a system of interaction. Generally speaking, if I've understood you correctly, you're talking about systems that interact with customers.
Yes.
often websites, e-commerce platforms, mobile, whatever it may be. And then you're saying that when you're going for a single stack these days, they're a lot more mature, so you're less likely to have to use different systems and integrate them.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah.
And by sticking to one stack, you get less friction, you get less costs, you get ease of use on the basis that the stack gives you what you need.
Correct. I think the challenge that you have with the single stack theory, though, is innovation doesn't necessarily go as fast as it does with, you know, startups, for example. If a startup builds a new tool around doing analytics or heat mapping or experience tracking at the system of interaction level, they may be able to move faster with product releases or new ideas than more stack approach, more platform-based system.
But if you're a large company, you don't have to wait for a startup to build something, though. You could potentially build it yourself.
That's right.
Or could you build it on top of a stack?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Like, I think part of the concept of platform thinking these days means that you have a stack that's available to you that you can then extend. So rather than building the foundational work from scratch, much like a systems of record, which you could do, you could extend those platforms. Systems of records can be modified. Most mm-hmm. systems these days, you can customized to some degree, whether using scripting languages or HTML or an API integration and so on. The same goes with the systems of interactions. Getting to a point where you're able to make it exactly what you need, I think, is a lot easier these days than it used to be. But I still see a lot of fragmentation. And I think in different areas of the market, and as you know, through the history of technology, there tends to be a bit of a gold rush for a period of time. Everybody and their dog starts up a business. They're all focusing on apps or, you know, web tracking tools or, you know, log file analysis, that kind of thing. And then eventually the market will consolidate down to a half a dozen key players. And I think that's starting to happen more at the systems of interaction level now. So you're getting that, you've already had that at the bottom layers in the systems of record, in the middle tiers around the operational parts of your business, and even transactional layer. But now the systems of interactions is coming into a what I think is that consolidation phase.
So what do you think are the top five vendors likely to be in that space?
It's a good question. First, I work for Salesforce. Now, I have to caveat that by saying my opinion's not necessarily directly related to Salesforce's opinion, so that's a good caveat. I need to put it front there, disclaimer. Look, I think there's obviously, if you look at the bigger players between Salesforce and Adobe and Microsoft, those are probably the top three, I would say, which is not surprising, really. There are a lot of other sort of second layer players that are doing some interesting stuff. I'm just thinking off the top of my head.
Sitecore?
Well, I'm not thinking so much in terms of content management or e-commerce execution now. I'm thinking the next layer up, which is more things like Crazy Egg and Google Analytics, Google 360. You know, there's a lot of places like that where the data that they're gathering, the streams of information they're gathering for individual users to try and then personalize that experience to a one-to-one conversation on your website or app or an email or whatever points of channels they've got, has become a lot more robust these days. Like, there's a lot more available for you to build that one-to-one personalization.
Okay, so say that I'm a business owner. When I mean business owner, I mean either own a line of business in a larger organization or in a complete business in a smaller one or even a larger one. But sort of a clean slate, and I was looking to implement something.
Hmm.
Do you think that we are at a stage where you could pick one stack and it'll look after everything that you would need from a systems of
interaction? I don't think so at this stage. I think there's still a lot of nuance with each one of the stack companies would be good at, say, 70%, 80% of things, depending on what they've got. One of the things that I will say is when you try to get into more of a platform-based approach, the vendors don't necessarily do a great job at integrating the different components into a platform. But that's the future state they're trying to get to.
So what do you mean by that? So the different components, what components are you talking
so
about?
So if we pick, let's pick Adobe, for example. So Adobe have this concept of Marketing Cloud. But within Marketing Cloud, there's lots of different components. There's Campaign and Target and a few other analytics and a few other key pieces. And a lot of those products were brought in by acquisition.
Right.
So they were considered to be good or best of breed in that market at the time of acquisition. They bring them in, put the Adobe label on top of that, and then from there, work to integrate the stacks together. So the quality of integration is a really big driver of whether or not the platform concept is successful for the business.
Right, okay. So when doing your research, that's something you're going to be thinking about.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a key thing. And I've made that mistake before. Sometimes the platform allure is quite interesting and sexy in a way. But if they don't have their integrations set up properly, then you're actually buying four or five separate units.
Right.
And it becomes as much of a headache as if you had different companies working with you.
So I found that when you flip that the other way, I mean, when I look at, say, the Microsoft store history, they bought CRM probably over 10 years ago now. Mm. And it was a disparate product when they first brought it in. But now it's like a lot of the Microsoft stack, it's really quite nicely integrated.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure that Microsoft have the whole suite of products in that offering yet, do they? Or there is a marketing automation component.
Look, I think they're on their way. One of the things that Microsoft that I've noticed over the years is they tend to be late to the game on a lot of these fronts, but then they accelerate very quickly and become market leaders really quickly. Through a variety of mechanisms. I guess they, you know, watch and learn, make smart acquisitions, look to see how they can better the product on its own, and then look to find ways to integrate it or put services wrapped around it. Azure is a really good example of that. You know, they started Azure off later than most other big organizations from a cloud computing perspective, but the product is amazing, and they've made it easier for people to consume compared to a lot of the other organizations in the market, which I never thought I would say, but you know, that's the strength of Microsoft. I think they've been able to get that far ahead with some areas of market. When it comes to things like systems of interaction, I think they're still behind a few of the other organizations. It hasn't really been a key focus for them.
No.
They've been very, you know, they've got the Office suite, they've got the Developer suite, they have the CRM, XRM, Dynamics ERP type processes. They never really have had, for example, a really good e-commerce platform they could count on until recent announcements, but I think it's coming. And again, you know, they do tend to come from behind in these things and become a market leader pretty quickly.
So from a psychology of technology perspective, having dealt with all the vendors, now you obviously work for one, do you find there's a different culture, a different flavor, a different kind of interaction? And obviously working for Salesforce is going to put you in a unique position in terms of answering this question. But do you find that the different vendors are different to deal with?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's a one of the acid tests that I look for when I'm talking to people in vendor land, and you know, obviously slightly biased at this point, but if you look at, and this comes to the psychology of technology in a way, one of the things that I try and find now is more of a cultural match between my organization and the vendor that I'm dealing with. Because if there's a value match and a cultural match there, it means that we're all kind of thinking in the same direction. That's a first step. So if I sit down with a vendor X and they do a presentation to me and I'm just not culturally aligned with the way that they behave, you know, red tie, blue suit kind of approach, then it's just not going to work.
Is that because you're like Hawaiian shirts and thongs?
So that's the kind of first step, is there has to be some sort of cultural alignment, which I don't think used to be an issue 10, 15, or 20 years ago. You really didn't think about that. But I think vendors these days are trying to build more, and customers also want to build this kind of partnership now.
So let me be clear about what I mean by vendor, because I want to make a distinction.
Sure.
When I talk about vendor, I'm talking about the platform vendors.
Yeah.
I don't mean the implementer.
No, I agree. That's what I'm saying.
I just want to make sure we're on the same page on that.
So I think one of the things that big vendors these days understand is if they are going to be in it for the long haul, especially as a SaaS provider, then they need to build a true partnership with the customer. And you see this happening more and more now with these big organizations putting together industry boards, industry bodies, events that bring a bunch of CIOs together, for example, or running bigger events to do things like a big marketing focus on marketing product and who's doing well. And I think that whole concept of trusted advisor has become a really important thing for these vendors now. Mm. And I think what's driving that is the cloud sales concept. So SaaS is a subscription model. People can walk away from a subscription model a lot easier than they could from a 5-year perpetual set and forget type approach. So that continuity of relationship is a lot more important. So that's the first thing I look at when I'm talking to vendors. The other thing I would look at would be, again, that concept of integration. What have they done to integrate it to a true platform concept? Because ultimately, we talk about customer 360. Everybody wants to have that single view of a customer across their business, which is driving a lot of digital transformation these days. Mm. And if you don't have a platform that ties together nicely and works well, then you have an issue with getting that 360 degree view. So looking at the integration strategy across products, I think is really critical to make sure that you're buying into something that makes sense for the future.
Yeah, look, there's a whole bunch of points that come to mind when listening to you talk about that. I think one of the things I'm thinking about is, let me just go back to the comment about the subscription model. I don't know, this is what I'm about to say is probably quite obvious, but it wasn't obvious to me when I first started to adopt the subscription model, because I got so excited about it. It was like, it doesn't cost very much money up front. But the one thing that I think some people are discovering is once you're committed to a subscription model, you are committed. And in comparison to the perpetual license concept, if you don't keep on paying, you get shut off. So I think the subscription model has its advantages, but it also, there are some things people be mindful of.
Sure.
From a pricing perspective. Another idea came to mind, which is imagine if a vendor took a position in which your success, their commercial success, to a certain extent, would be impacted by your commercial success. So from a pricing model, so you do well, they do well, you don't do well, they don't do well. Have you seen that in the marketplace?
Yeah, absolutely. So their Salesforce, for example, has what they call the skin in the game approach when it comes to their Commerce Cloud business. So they charge, there's a concept called GMV, gross merchandising value. Got that. And what that means is there's a percentage of sales that goes against the licensing fee. So if you sell $100,000 or $1 million, you pay a percentage of the sale back to the organization. So so there is that concept of skin in the game, which means that it does change, again, the relationship and the agreements, and the way that the cadence of that relationship takes place is different than if you had less skin in the game.
So in that scenario, do the account execs have more to be interested in?
Yes.
Right, because their remuneration is tied in with the results of the client.
Exactly. Right. But the other thing you need to consider from a SaaS perspective is the account reps are, and the business in general are, it's so important for renewals to occur. So if you have attrition off of an account, if people are not using the product broadly enough or stop using the product or are not happy with the product and they're not going to renew, and it does happen, then it has a big impact. As you know, an existing customer is much easier and cost effective to keep than there is to try and find a new one. So there is this, I think there's a symbiosis now. There is a true partnership that happens between vendors and customers. And what you find now is, at least what I've seen, is the sales cycles may be a bit longer at the beginning, especially in Australia. Very relationship-based sales process that happens here.
Yeah.
Because we really want to know as two partners, and it works both ways, do we actually want to get in cahoots with each other and have a true partnership and this lasts, and we can both demonstrate value to each other over the course of a relationship, as compared to what it used to be, where you just, chuck a perpetual license to somebody, they pay $5 million up front. You wouldn't necessarily see an account rep for the next 5 years.
So how does it work now? I mean, is it the case that you've got your account reps coming like regularly, once a month or something?
I guess it depends on the level of account rep to customer relationship ratio, effectively. So obviously the bigger the customer, the bigger spend they are, the more attention they're going to get. Or if they have potential to become a bigger customer, the more attention they will get. It's just normal. You can't have a one-to-one relationship with salesperson to customer account
but
in the market.
How much in the weeds would the account execs be? I mean, this is both a technical and psychological discussion.
Sure.
So do you have the account reps sort of feeling the pain of the customer and actually going away and thinking about how to solve the problems?
Yep. I think in most large vendor organizations and even the smaller ones as well, they will constantly be notified or be able to review usage patterns, complaint cycles, support requests, all the touch points that you would get from a customer to indicate whether or not they're happy, including things like voice of the customer conversations.
Right.
So giving the opportunity for a customer to talk 15, 20 minutes, half an hour, and present, on a quarterly basis where they think they're at from a implementation perspective, if they're happy with the product, if they're happy with the service they're getting, and so on. So there is a lot more intimacy and a lot more regular contact than I would say there was historically with perpetual licensing.
So obviously your background is technical, as in you used to be hands-on, completely, fully technical. You still, I think, dabble, if I understand correctly.
Yep.
But you, for the last 10, 15 years of your career, you've been very much focused on the human side as well as the technical. Is it your experience that most of the customer or client-facing reps have a deep technical capability?
I wouldn't say deep technical capability, but they do have enough understanding of the technology side of it and how it fits in with the customer success than they had before. I've worked and talked to people who have been selling technology for 30 or 40 years. They still need people like us to build architecture diagrams and integrate with the tech. I think one of the things that's also changed over the last few years is, software as a service opened the door for having conversations with the business rather than going through IT.
Right.
So there was a period of time where you could talk to a CCO or a chief operating officer or a CEO directly, or head of a department that sat inside business, and have them subscribe to a product and have it up and running without IT being involved. So it created a bit of a shift between, like a power dynamic shift, and also created a lot of headaches for tech, because tech then would have to pick that maintenance of that system up. But there was a bit of a gold rush there for a while, and I think it started to polarize the conversations between the salespeople, the customer success people, and the customer, and then eventually IT. So that's come full circle again. I would say that IT is insisting more to be at the table when it comes to talking to SaaS vendors, especially at operational level. And it's kind of going back to a bit more of a traditional approach. However, along the way, roles have changed too. The CIO role is not the same as it used to be. You have the concept of a CTO that is almost like a chief digital officer now. They need to be more aware of customer data, integration, marketing, cloud type approaches.
Yeah.
A lot has shifted in the last 10 or 15 years for sure.
So are you finding now that IT is playing a significantly different role than, say, 10 years ago?
Yes and no. So the difference would be that they need to be more aware of the breadth of use cases effectively within an organization than they ever had before. Because there's a lot of use cases that can be satisfied without them being involved, if that makes sense. So you could spin up an entire marketing initiative platform that will do campaigning integrations to your back-end systems, running reports and so on. And that can live inside a bubble that tech doesn't really understand much about.
Yeah.
But they do need to understand enough to know how it engages with the rest of the platform, rest of the organization and their environment as well. So it is shifting for sure.
And is that impacting the way vendors are treating IT?
Yes, I would say that it's, again, because CIOs, for example, are becoming less of, if you look at what I consider traditional CIO, it was more a case of, you know, keeping the lights on, managing infrastructure, looking after security and policy, making sure they stay out of the news from a data breach perspective. And then they would flow down things like delivery and development into a CTO or other heads of engineering and so on. Nowadays, I see the CIO as being more of, they're at the exec table now, as opposed to answering into potentially a CFO. Mm. They're making decisions both on value drivers for the business, security across all the platforms they have, but they also really need to understand more about what digital execution means. And I know the word digital is kind of a funny one to bring out, because we've been doing digital for our whole lives. It's just become a term in the last 15 or 20 years.
We're both 25, but we're 30 years experience each.
So I think the concept of digital has brought forward this view of how do we do things in a digital way, and the stuff that usually comes out of that would be the marketing and customer interaction piece. So what I'm saying now is CIOs almost need to think a bit, almost like a CMO, a bit like a chief digital officer in a way. So they need to think more about customer data, customer interaction,
right,
reporting analytics. They need to be on top of those kinds of things where they historically didn't.
Maybe a modern day CIO is, obviously they've got that technical aspect to them, but they're also going to be a lot more human facing from what you're saying.
Much more human facing.
Yeah, because I mean, we remember the days when you could build any old thing, as long as it was technically right, the job was done.
Yep.
These days, I think the theme of what you're saying is customer first, customer first, and customers just expect the tech to work. What they don't tolerate is a bad experience.
That's right.
And technology is a component of that. Obviously, you have customer service and the products itself, but I think everybody here now there's a pretty high bar for the frictionless experience of using technology, where that wasn't the case maybe even 5 years ago. There are some pretty significant websites or digital properties out there that are still lagging, but they have such a large customer base that they kind of get away with it. But most modern platforms if you need to cough, because I'll cut the coughs out. Most modern platforms seem to be much smoother from a user experience perspective.
Yeah, look, and it's getting better, right? And I think that's one of the key points of differentiation when you look at businesses. So coming back to the topic that we wanted to discuss today about the viability of businesses in general and how they differentiate themselves in the marketplace, I think customer experience is such a broad term that you can talk for days about what that actually means. But really what it comes down to is how easy, if you think in terms of transactional systems, how easy is it for somebody to make a purchase on your website? And then also how easy is it for them to find you? So looking through the whole funnel of from awareness in the marketplace all the way through to transaction and then post-sale. What are the things that need to be addressed at that point?
I also wonder about brand promise or brand identity. So, you know, a lot of people like to be associated with a particular brand. And I'm not going to mention the fruit brand, but that was a classic. That is a classic. But how is that something that technically now we need to be expressing, and how do we express it?
Because building a brand is so hard, especially starting off fresh. I think the benefit of hindsight from brands that are successful these days is they made some really smart moves in the beginning, and they focused on, I think I mentioned this to you before, they focus on, in my view, there's four different ways to differentiate your business, and you can be on a different axis for each one of these. So there's the level of customer intimacy that you have. And with customer intimacy comes the ability to do one-to-one conversations, be able to know that customer deeply, have enough information to make decisions on how you actually work with them. Then there's the kind of the concept around product leadership. So how good is your product, or how much of a range do you have for your product, and how well does it fit the market? I think the fruit company, for example, placed some big bets early on in their existence, and when they dropped their first digital device, it wasn't great, but it was interesting, and it fit a certain way of thinking. And it rallied an audience behind them that was quite powerful, and this audience spent a lot of money on their first set of products that gave the organization the opportunity to then reinvest and make it better and better and better, and that continues to be their success. But off the back of that, they also have operational excellence. So their service historically has been pretty good. Mm-hmm. Good warranty, good logistics, supply chains really tight. Everything just was lined up in a way that made sense to support that. So that's the third pillar. So basically have customer intimacy, product leadership or range, operational excellence. And then the final piece is the value piece. So you could compete with other organizations on cost, but that's a race to the bottom potentially. But finding the balance between those four axes gives you an opportunity to differentiate yourself in the marketplace. There's probably other ones, multiple other ways of doing it, but I think they kind of boil down into those four key aspects.
So interesting. So I think that the fruit company's success is obviously not by is not by accident. It's obviously by design, and a lot of that design is happening below the hood, and we're not seeing it. I think one of the things also that they managed to do very well was come up with this, we're kind of cool in the tech space, and if you play with us, you can be cool too.
Yeah.
And I think that's really important to kind of work out who you are as a company, irrespective of whether you're in or out of tech, and how you want to be seen. We're working with a retailer at the moment. They have a particular position in the market, and they're trying to expand. And the question is, are they going to try to reposition themselves, or are they going to start another brand? And then if they're going to go with the latter option, what is that customer experience going to be, and how is that going to be supported by technology?
Yep.
These are big strategic decisions to be made. And to a certain extent, you don't know if they're going to succeed unless you try them. I can think of a particular a company that owns a collection of furniture brands. And in that stable of brands, they have a high end or sort of mid to high, and they have a low end. Which is really bizarre is that the difference between the low end and the high end from a pricing perspective is almost nothing.
Mm.
It's just the way that they, when you go to the low end shop, you kind of go, oh, this, everything must be cheap because of the way they presented it. But I think when it comes to the transaction side of it, which is supported by digital, I don't know that people will be that forgiving, even if you're offering a cheap brand, that your technology experience is a bad experience.
There's a difference between bad experience and perception of value. So I think on this fourth axis around the concept of value, it also relates to values to me as well. So when these organizations, for example, will go, okay, we've got a market here. Let's say we start off with the finer end of furniture, right? And the total addressable market is $500 million in Australia, just to pick a round number. And we know that that demographic that can afford that and sits with that, you know, aligns with these kinds of values. And they'll pick four or five, and then that'll be kind of a driver behind all of the decisions they make around, you know, what their store looks like, what people wear in the shops.
Mm.
How far they go from a customer service perspective and so on. And then they'll look at, let's double our total addressable market by going to the lower cost environment. What do people want in that space? How do we respond to their value set? They want cheap. Let's make it look a bit cheaper in the environment. So it's put up that way. I think when it comes to online, they can still do the same thing from a values perception perspective. But when it comes down to the customer experience, it still has to be seamless. Yeah. So, I've had some very frustrating interactions with the fruit company recently online, trying to make it work properly, having to jump through so many hoops, and it's been really frustrating for me. And that's supposed to be a high value proposition.
Yeah.
If I had that across any kind of value chain or value level, I would be frustrated and want to walk away from it as well. So online is, the key focus, I think, online is if you want to be able to sell low-value things and attract a low-value customer, then by all means make your iconography and, color scheme, all that kind of stuff cheaper looking. But if you want that higher value, go polish at the top end. But in the middle, that whole transaction workflow has to be seamless.
Mm. So I think on reflection and summary, from a differentiation perspective, it looks to me that there's a certain level of technology and smoothness that's required by all customers, and that has to be there. If we are going to use, we're going to use existing stacks, which are maturing all the time, there's plenty of opportunities to make those quite unique. And often there are building blocks on top of that that we can use to go a bit further. It's important to get our brand aligned. It's important to get our experience aligned with our brand and to be really clear about our value proposition. So I think they're the things that I've got from today. And I want to thank you for your time, Mr. Raven.
My pleasure.
It's the only time I'm ever going to call you Mr., just for the record. Before we sign off, got any exciting plans for the weekend?
I'm going to dig up a 4-meter by 4-meter concrete slab.
He mustn't understand the word exciting.
It's pretty exciting.
Is that it?
With a sledgehammer.
Okay.
And then I'm going to pour some concrete down to make the...
Okay.
But no. Otherwise, no, nothing. I got nothing.
All right. So thank you once again for your time, and look forward to talking to you again soon.
Cool.
See you later.
Bye.